Hi, today's December 27th, 2020. This is MobiViews Podcast 345. I'm Todd Agasa-Walter with my good friend John Westfall, and today we have two guest panelists back, Paul Lawler and Don Sorcinelli. And this is the last podcast of 2020, but somehow I'm not sad at all. It's like, I will be glad when I don't have to utter the words 2020, at least, you know, in context of being the current year. Not a fun year for anybody, I'm sure. Anyway, so this podcast, I wanted to key off something that Don was talking about last week, either briefly on the podcast or maybe after the podcast. We're kind of talking about being in organizations during this pandemic and how what are not so much a technical response, although some of us are responsible for that too, but more or less, you know, the technical overview of what we ran into. And all of us work for or with a bunch of organizations and different kinds of organizations too. So we'll be able to, I think, have a couple of different points of view. But before we begin, I would just want to mention that, you know, before the podcast, I was talking to the guys and I was mentioning to them that according to this Reuters article, laptops and desktop sales are still seeing shortages because, you know, everybody's buying them. And Reuters is saying that the analysts, they quote, say the shortages won't ease until 2022. At first, I thought, oh, yeah, 2021. I read it as 2021. I thought, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, we're coming up. We're like a week away. Or shortages will be eased. But no, it says 2022. So we're talking about, you know, another full year plus before the shortages ease. So it's going to be a rough one if you still haven't been able to find the laptop or desktop you wanted. And I also noted that that number that the analysts are expecting for 2020 is about 300 million shipments, and that's up from 15% in 2019. And it is the same as the 2008 peak of PC sales, also 300 million. So, you know, it took 12 years and a pandemic to right things. You know, another interesting thing to me is that although it's a very small market, now that Apple is more or less abandoning or in the process of abandoning Intel chips. You know, Intel took a little bit of a hit, 4 or 5%, I would guess, of their sales go to Apple or went to Apple. But more interestingly, apparently Microsoft is taking a look at building its own ARM processor and powering Windows. They already have ARM version of Windows, WOA, Windows on ARM. But it'll be interesting to see if Microsoft abandons the Wintel pairing that's, you know, worked for so many decades.
Well, Todd, my question is, in all of this, did Reuters give any credit to the PC explosion, strictly to Microsoft Flight Simulator being released?
Did you get that?
I don't have a PC to run it on.
I was going to say the same thing. I don't have any PC, or I guess it runs. Does it run an Xbox? And I don't have a modern Xbox, so, you know, I have like a Xbox 360.
Yeah, it is slated for 2021, but it will be exclusive to Xbox Series X and Xbox Series S, the next gen.
Okay, so all new stuff. Or
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was, like I said, I was never good at Flight Simulator, and I'm talking about 1.0, you know, on the PC with its kind of shaky vector graphics and everything. I could kind of take off. It was a landing that, you know. It was always a problem for me. I would usually fly until it ran out of fuel, and, you know, then you'd crash, and all right, we're done. It's easier than landing. Okay, John has kind of a, I don't know if it's a rant before we get started.
It's an interesting observation. So a couple of weeks ago, in somewhat of a surprise announcement, Apple released AirPods Max, and the overwhelming thing that I think, if you stop anyone on the street and say, have you heard of AirPods Max, the thing they will say is, yeah, those $550 headphones. The price point is really all people are talking about outside of those who have used them. And yeah. So, you know, I initially had the same reaction. I thought, well, $550, no, there's no way I would ever consider $550 for headphones.
Right.
Of course, you know, if I combine the two headphones I use the most, which are the AirPods Pro and the Beats Solo 3s that I'm using right now,
right,
it costs $550 together to buy both of those. But, you know, that withstanding, So then, and of course, if you look at blogs, I'm actually looking at a couple of posts on Mac Rumors right now, and just every comment, I'm not even being, you know, dramatic. It's literally almost every comment is there's just way too much money for that. You know, one person put five reasons to consider it. Well, I have 550 reasons not to consider it. The next person goes, well, comfort is subjective and noise cancellation is great, but worse than these or whatever. So on paper and in comment sections, these things are just trashed for their actual price point.
Yeah.
But when you actually start watching the video reviews, one of the ones that I'll link to in our show notes is a reviewer, Michael Fisher, Mr. Mobile, talking about his video is literally titled, I Hate How Much I Love Apple's AirPods Max. And it's a very interesting observation to me that much like other Apple products we've seen in the past, namely the Apple Watch, people seem to want to hate this thing. And then as soon as they get it, they start to say, wow, it might actually be worth it, even though it pains them greatly to say it. So I am not 100% sold to try them yet or purchase them yet, but I am very interested because it just seems like a really weird psychological shift that people have made with it from looking at it on paper to actually trying it on their own ears.
Well, John, I also attribute to the same feeling that people have after they've had an organ surgically removed. Up until that point, they're not in favor of it. And that $550 is like an organ. But once it's done, and now I'm going on and I feel healthier without that bad organ in there, I might be a little bit ticked off about what's happened, but I'm still alive. So
yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because amongst the four of us, Don and I have very practical and relatively inexpensive wired earbuds plugged into our heads for this podcast, where Paul and John both have, I think, Apple Beats over the ear, you know, not $550, I don't think, but not cheap.
Well,
either.
Mine are the Bose QC35-2s, which are $339.
So not cheap, but not $550.
When I bought my Solo 3s, I paid $299 for them.
Yeah, and even that, I bet it was sort of like, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was. And I did not understand. I took a gamble on it, and I've now used them for 3-4 years without a problem. And so it's an interesting paradox, I think. But I also, if you just want an interesting psychological experience, go watch some of these reviews and see these reviewers grapple with it. And it's not always that they bought it themselves. In some cases, they, you know, it was review units, so you can't say it's just simple cognitive dissonance I just dropped $550 and I can't stand that I did that.
Right.
I think to some extent, they're good. Are they $550 good? Who knows?
Well,
if any company was going to do $550 good, it would probably be Apple.
You know, John, about a month ago, I think you and I had a podcast right after the Max came out. And you almost convinced me to buy one. And the only thing that stopped me was $550. You know?
What else is new, Todd? I mean, there's something I wouldn't bet against. If John decides to try to convince you to buy something, I walk away at that point.
You know, John's not a clinician, but, you know, he's still a psychologist. He's dangerous.
Well, I pulled up our show notes from January 4th to kind of look at what, because Don was on with us then, and Sven, who's the other one who I know will buy anything with me, Sven. But, you know, the first thing that we talked about on January 4th was the Elcro Crow Pie, which I convinced Todd to buy.
I'm still, you know, almost a year later. I got it, I think, in January of this year. I still use it once. But, you know, it's a beautiful machine, and I'm really looking forward to getting some time to play with it. I'm really trying to make some time to play with it in 2021. That's one of my New Year's resolutions. So, we'll see.
Well, if not in 726 days, 5 hours, 13 minutes, and 8 seconds, you'll have some time.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping, too. Let me see how accurate you are. Yep, there you go. And John and I both have countdown timers for my retirement. But
I think I just added it just to freak you out, yeah. actually, because you had put it one day on Facebook, and I thought I might as well start counting down, too.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, Apple has done this to me in particular in the past, right? The first one was in the very first iPod came out. And it was, wasn't it like $600 or $499 or $599? It was a lot with a 5 gigabyte hard drive in the iPod. I remember people were buying the iPod just to get the hard drive and putting it in their, you know, in their pocket PC or whatever as a solid state, you know, large, what was large back then? 5 gigabytes, a large solid state device, right? And I remember looking at the iPod and saying, man, who's going to pay $500 to, you know, carry music around in their pocket? I mean, there were already MP3 players, but they were tiny. You know, they could hold maybe an album's worth of songs on a good day. And of course, Steve Jobs said, well, you can have your, it turns out not to be true, but he said, oh, you can carry your entire music collection on this thing, you know, and never be without it. And I thought, this thing is not going to sell at all. And Apple's going to tank. And I was wrong, obviously. And the next one was when the first iPhone came out with no apps. It was $600 because it was the first phone I recall that had no subsidy by default. I mean, there was nowhere you could buy it with a subsidy. It was $600, one color, take it or leave it, you know? And I thought, well, no, who's going to buy a $600 phone? That's just crazy. And then I saw the lines outside the Apple store and I was wrong again. So, you know, I could be wrong about this Max thing.
I don't think that the iPod was the iPod. I'm sorry. I don't think the iPod was because of the iPod, Todd. I think it was because of iTunes.
You know, that's a really good point. That is it made music easy to get without ripping a CD.
Buy any song you want for a dollar.
Yeah. You are right. iTunes was the game changer. And a few years later, well, more than a few years later, I guess, but 8 years later, the App Store, again, for, you know, a lot of apps were a dollar back then. Okay, well, I'm still thinking about it. I'm thinking probably not, but I'm still, it's just that price tag is.
Oh, yeah. It's a painful price point, but yeah. It's interesting to me because of just the reactions of reviewers that I'm pretty sure were very motivated to say that it was overpriced and are having a very hard time saying that, which is interesting.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, as someone who buys a lot of Apple stuff, I think I can say this without, you know, alienating a lot of people. I buy a lot of Apple stuff. Apple stuff is overpriced a lot of times. It's you know, the only reason now some of it doesn't seem overpriced is because the other manufacturers have decided to do the same thing and also overcharge. So, you know, the Samsung high-end phones are the same price as the, you know, iPhone Pro Max and all that kind of stuff. And so it doesn't seem as abnormal as it used to. But let's face it, when we're paying the price we were paying for a phone exceeded the price I paid for my new laptop, that's just wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and let's, since we talked about Samsung, the tweets and everything this week started getting deleted where they were making fun of Apple for not shipping a charger. Yeah, that hit because they're not going to ship a charger anymore. So anyone, you know, after the headphone jack debacle a few years ago where they did the exact same thing, said, oh, we still have it, and then they got rid of it. Anyone who thought Samsung had any credibility in their marketing by saying, oh, we're going to include that charger, they just don't follow things that closely to know that the writing was on the wall.
But, you know, Steve Jobs used to do the opposite, right? He used to claim, oh, you don't need a color screen in your iPod, and next year there was. Or, no, we're never going to make a phone, and then the next year there was. And, you know, and even the tablets, right? I mean,
nobody wants a stylus.
Yeah, nobody wants a stylus. So, although he did pass away before the Apple Pencil came out. But one wonders if that was on his roadmap, you know, because they said that when he passed away, there was a 5-year roadmap he left behind. So.
Or they pried it out of his dead hands.
Maybe
I understand, John, that's the plot for the last Indiana Jones movie. He has to go to Steve Jobs' tomb and find that 5-year roadmap.
I thought it was gonna be a golden idol iPod or something like that.
I thought it was gonna be like Citizen Kane, and you know, his last word was stylus.
Well, based on Indiana Jones's age, I don't know that there could be much of an adventure in this last adventure that's going to be done with Harrison Ford.
Well, you can never tell, you know, with Hollywood. They could always do a CGI version of Harrison Ford.
Deep fake.
Right? I mean, Will Smith. Wasn't there a Will Smith movie recently where they had him plus a young version of him in the same movie? That was all CGI'd. But anyway.
Yep.
Well, how old was Sean Connery when they did the one with him as Indiana Jones' father?
Oh. Yeah. I don't know. Well, he just passed away this year, and how old was he, like 90?
Yeah.
So he must have been 70, so he's a spring chicken. I mean, there are a lot of Hollywood types doing stuff in their 70s. It's really kind of amazing what they can do if they don't kill themselves, you know, on the way to stardom. But anyway, so the topic this week is one that kind of keys off of what Don mentioned last in our podcast last week. I thought, oh, I really want to hear what the guys have to say about that. And that's, you know, the technical observations we've made of what we use and why we use them during the pandemic and how they're used. And I'll start by saying that the thing that bothers me the most is, you know, all the meetings we've had, the increase in meetings, where, you know, I'm wearing a headset, which is kind of unnatural in my opinion. Even though, you know, I've been doing this podcast for 12 years now. But I don't do it for, you know, 10 hours a day. You know, an hour, 40 minutes to an hour and a half, that's fine. But doing it all day long, it's a little weird. But the thing that bothers me is that people take care of their visual background. You know, make sure that they, you know, they've cleaned the back of their room or whatever and it looks presentable. But they don't care what they actually sound like. And so you're on these large conference calls and go, what did that guy say? Or what did that lady say? I can't hear them. You know, they're too far away from the mic, or they're blowing out their mic because they're talking up real close like this.
You know? Well, don't you think that at least a certain aspect of that just shows how many people never really use the technology, number one, followed by number two, they were never really taught how to use the technology in 2020. I think the biggest, one of the biggest challenges next to implementing the technology this year, a lot of times on short notice, was training people properly on how to use the technology afterwards.
Yeah.
It's great that we enabled people to work remotely, but we didn't teach them an awful lot about it. So whether we want to call it online manners or behaviors, or I think a lot of it was just learned on the fly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And it led to a lot. I agree with you that a lot of meetings were spent, especially in the early months, and this was including meetings I attended with people who were supposed to be tech savvy. You know, a lot of those early meetings were getting people to understand how to effectively use the tools. And sometimes it was how to just be heard properly.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, I mean, John and I have gone through years of this now where we says, John, how's my microphone sound? I can't hear you. You know, and I look, because, you know, I bought a new microphone and turns out it's a dud and I didn't really test it before I actually connected with John. And so I'd have to swap out, you know, something more reliable. And I've gone through a bunch, and I've bought a Snowball, and this is a, whatever the heck this is. What is this one? This is a Blue Yeti, I think. And I've had some less expensive USB microphones and some just headsets. You know, I've gone through a whole bunch, and the audio quality has varied greatly over the years, especially if you listen to the early podcasts where like you said, Don, I really didn't know what I was doing. You know, I didn't really even know how to record it properly.
Well, it's interesting from my perspective as somebody who's been doing implementations and rollouts of technology to large organizations for, you know, about 15 years now. A lot of that was mobility. You know, how are we gonna roll out this? I'm always very mindful of the last step in the process, which is the user actually using what we're giving them.
Yeah.
And I think in the IT world, we have an awful track record historically of not giving a damn to that last step. It's everything to get to that last step. And, oh, we've given it to the user. I'm done. It's been nice knowing you.
Yeah, very true.
And I think this year was an incredible example of thrusting a lot onto end users in a lot of cases on very short notice, but still a lot of times I'd work on these implementations and I can't tell you, I felt like the guy watching the train come down the track with somebody standing right on the track. Guys, you're going to implement this. What's your plan to at least give some survival training to your end users? Yeah. Oh yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And training for implementation is the equivalent for years as a developer was the equivalency of writing the documentation, which nobody wanted to do. And yep, we'd get to the end of the project and we'd be lucky if we got any of it. I think that's a big problem this year.
The problem that I noticed and you know saw firsthand was that because the whole work-at-home thing was so unexpected, not just unplanned, but unexpected. Yeah. You know, we literally just sent home people saying, hey, you know what? There's an emergency proclamation. We're all going home tomorrow.
Yeah. And I congratulate so many organizations, both in the public and the private sector, for making the effort to make it work.
Yeah.
But if there was one consistent thing that I found this year that kind of drove me nuts was, like I said, I've spent a lot of years saying, congratulations, you're doing superhuman effort to enable people to work remotely. But you kind of have to show them how to do it, too. And for so many people in the workforce, it reminds me of 2010, giving them a smartphone and saying, here you go, use it. You know, it's going to be able to get your email and it's going to be able to, you know, you're going to be able to do these things. We'll see you later.
Yeah.
You know, and not teaching people how to use it. Where it, this is the next iteration of it that's happening. Yeah. I do believe, and I honestly believe that in the long run, we'll all be better for what's happened, because as we saw back in 2008, 2010, you know, people really started to get used to the technology. It just took a while. I think the same thing's going to happen with what's happened this year. It's just going to take a while. And hopefully, you know, along the way, we teach people the right way to use this.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, because especially like in large conference calls, I won't say the hardest, but it was the non-intuitive thing that we had to start teaching people was how to raise your hand, you know, whether it's a digital hand or an actual hand, and how to mute and unmute, and really, really simple things. And I'm kind of looking at the back row with Dr. John Westfall and Mr. Paul Lawler. Well, both university educators, and ask them, you know, as actual teachers, What did you teach your students and colleagues on how to do this, how to enable, you know, maybe not full on digital teaching, but you know, just getting them online and making sure that they had the basics to get something done, if not everything.
Well, you know, I took the approach, meet them where they are,
and
figure out what we can slowly nudge ahead. So, for example, you were talking about the raise hand feature, which is common in a lot of video conferencing software. Zoom is what we use primarily, and it has it. But I would say still, in any given meeting I'm in, maybe only 10% of the participants know how to use that feature.
Mm.
And 10% of the hosts know to check for it. And so I always, you know, when I teach, I tell my students, okay, I will, you know, if you do use the reaction buttons, I'm looking for those. I have the chat window up, so if you're going to throw something in chat, I'll see that. If you want to unmute and speak, that's fine as well. Here are your options. Do whichever ones basically you are comfortable and know how to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I think I've been telling as guidance to my colleagues is just you can't expect students are going to immediately click with how you want them to use the software, because your own colleagues haven't figured out the raise hand feature, and it's so analogous to what we do in the actual classroom. It's painfully obvious how to use it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the non-obvious thing to me was that I noticed is that in large groups, and basically large is anything more than 10 to me, where you know, there's a somebody presenting, maybe it's like a seminar or it's just a regular presentation, you know, project presentation. It is difficult to make a presentation where you're kind of looking at your slides and, you know, basically you're not Steve Jobs. You know, you're not a super presenter. You're looking at your slides. You're trying to make a point. And people are raising their hands. So people have learned to raise their hands or, you know, type something in chat window. But they don't know that because they don't do what you do, John. And it's difficult to do. It's really difficult to do, in my opinion. And one of the things we tried to teach people was, if you're going to do a large presentation, is have a partner whose mm-hmm. job is to be the moderator, you know, to keep an eye on. This is, hey, you know, John, you know, so-and-so has a question, or so-and-so has a hands up. Can we, you know, pause and respond to these questions?
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Todd, because I think one of the things that I've noticed is this was the year that we promoted a lot of software as meeting software.
Yep.
Its history was webinar software.
Yeah.
And it was oriented towards a non-responsive, minimal interactive yep. audience.
Yep.
Or it was totally synchronous. You put questions into a queue and then got to them at yep. a certain point. And again, there's a lot of learning that went on. And I think you brought up something that was I believe in a lot, in that meetings that were over a few people, you had to take that kind of approach.
Yeah.
What you described. And that was always an effective webinar, was a second person that was your eyes on the audience.
Yep.
And as long as that person also worked well with you as a teammate to tell you and communicate with you, you know, but it's funny, but all this software that was supposed to be so great for meetings, I think had its roots in being great for presenting, but not necessarily interacting well.
Yeah.
So it requires some thinking, and you brought up a great point, how to apply something from our past to make it work today. Yeah.
And it is more difficult in a teaching environment, especially at the university level, where typically you don't have a partner, you know, to tag team. I don't know, Paul, what was your experience like over the last, I guess, two semesters now?
Well, I found it was interesting that the same students who would kind of try to sit inconspicuously in the back of the class and hope that you wouldn't see them and call on them have now figured out that if they put themselves on mute and turn off their camera, that's the digital equivalent of sitting inconspicuously in the back row.
It's funny you mentioned that, Paul, because my son's school district, at the high school level at least, they mandate that you cannot turn off. You can mute, but you can't turn off your camera during the lecture part of any of the classes. That was a change. It's funny. We talk about how much you learn. That the March and the springtime, what they were doing on the fly for remote learning versus what they've done the second time around, there's a lot of those things. And as soon as you said that, I started to laugh to myself, because that was the first thing my son was like, yeah, you got to keep the camera on.
So for Paul, did you start mandating that your students need to turn on their video, or what was your reaction to that? Your response to that?
Well, I did not, because they're college students, right?
Yeah.
I don't feel like I should treat them like high school students.
Yeah.
But I got really tired of talking to a bunch of muted avatars. So basically about halfway through the semester, I went to a format where I would just pre-record my lectures in small chunks.
Yeah.
You know, 10, 15 minute chunks. And then I would release the chunks to them and they could watch it on their own.
Oh, so basically, old school unit offline. Mastery.
Yeah, basically.
Which has been effective for many, 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 many years. So,
yeah, it's interesting. You know, I don't require my students to turn on their webcam either, and a lot of my colleagues do. And I find that really dicey with college students. And I think it's because these are primarily the colleagues that have high school and lower age kids at home, and they see that the teachers in K through 12 are saying you have to have it on.
I see.
And they think, oh, I'll just do that with my college students. But you know, I just tell my students point blank, look, if you don't want to turn on your webcam, I know you might be in a place where you really can't have it on, or you know, you're not in a private setting, whatever. Yeah. Just remember, you're paying for this class.
Yeah.
And so if you don't want to get the value out of it by interacting, that's your business. Unlike Paul, I don't mind talking to myself a lot. So, but I have done the same thing where I've released lectures early, and students know that when they sign on to Zoom, we're going to be talking. We're not going to be listening to just me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I haven't looked at the data in years, but unit mastery really works. It's kind of non-confrontational. It's non-threatening to a lot of people. You kind of do things on your own. And, you know, if you don't do it on time, you get an F. You know? But that was up to you. You know, you were told you need to do these 30 things to, you know, get a credit. And you did zero, so.
Well, I mean, I do offer interactive sessions as well.
Yeah.
I don't mandate them.
Right.
Say like, okay, we're going to have a review for the exam. If you want to come and ask questions, you can. If you don't want to come, it's up to you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and speaking of video and speaking of post, you know, secondary education, like, you know, regular people, at the beginning, a lot of people turned on their video cameras. But more and more, we started turning them off, you know. I know I did pretty early on. I just said, ah, the heck with it. You know, I really want to comb my hair this morning. And I usually, you know, I noticed other people did the same thing. We just started turning off our cameras. Some groups really want their cameras on. I think some groups actually mandate, kind of like, you know, K through 12. They mandate that video conference meetings actually have the video part of it. Which is okay, but I don't know.
I think I mentioned to you previously, I keep my camera on in a business world, at least for the start of my meetings.
Yeah.
Especially with customers.
Yeah.
To a certain extent for self-accountability. To be honest, it makes me make sure that I'm still in a working, a work-minded mindset.
Yeah.
Number one, it makes sure that I dress at least semi-appropriately. And especially when dealing with customers, I found I had traditionally, before this all happened, almost all the engagements I did for implementations tended to be on site. I traveled a lot to customer locations and did the work. And part of it was, and part of the success of that was when the customer can see you, good, bad, or otherwise, they feel you're more accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So when we went suddenly to all remote, I felt, and it did turn out in a lot of engagements to be this way, that when the customer saw me during a meeting in person, it gave them at least, while I wasn't there physically, I was there virtually.
Yeah.
And they could see me. They could see how I would react to question and answer,
right,
or when we'd meet. And I think it helped an awful lot,
right,
on engagements. So it to me, it was a lot of personal accountability keeping that camera on. But I know at least on several occasions, customers, I was surprised in the end, actually appreciate.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, we don't record the video of these podcasts, but for those of you who never met Don Sorcinelli, he has one of the most expressive faces I've ever met.
I don't play much poker as a result.
No, Don is not a poker player. So, oh, Don surprised by what I just said. Oh, Don is not happy with what I just said.
Yeah, I do agree, though. There have been times where I've started a meeting with a camera on and somebody said, well, I'm not going to turn my camera on. If you know, you can turn yours off if you want.
Yeah.
You know, I do appreciate, and I think to a great extent, both, you know, I can imagine from John's perspective and Paul's perspective as well, it's, you know, whatever works.
Yeah.
And we're adults. We don't have to babysit.
Yeah.
You know, and whether it be in the educational realm or in the business realm, if somebody says, I don't want to do that, as long as we get the job done, I don't care if it's audio only either.
Yeah.
You know,
I will say that if I'm the primary presenter slash speaker, whatever, of a meeting, or if I'm the convener, I will turn my camera on. But if, you know, I'm only going to answer a question and say one sentence, I won't do it unless there's, you know, some sort of kind of mutual agreement that that's what you're supposed to do. And that's very rare. Most people don't request that.
What I do is I usually at the beginning of a class will ask for audio feedback from each of them so that I know that I can hear them. They can hear me.
Yeah. Hey, what, you know, and speaking of that, you know, since you've got students presumably giving some audio feedback now and then for both of you, for Paul and for John, do you have any issues with the microphones you use, or is that, you know, they use their AirPods or whatever, and, or, you know, EarPods, and it's all just fine?
The only issue I have is with the screaming children. That is primarily the issue that my students, you know, the demographic that we have, and the sort of situation that many of them are in, is that the background noise is screaming children and them screaming back at the children. So that is really the only thing that would prevent me from telling all my students to keep an open mic, because that would be way too distracting. The quality is hit or miss, you know.
Yeah.
Depends on the web or the webcam mic or the computer's mic. Very few of them are using anything other than just a built-in condenser microphone.
Okay.
So it's a good thing that I don't have my playing on my other computer my YouTube videos of scream therapy sessions and how effective they are.
I'd probably just tune it out.
Well, you know, we haven't gotten it in our Microsoft Teams tenant yet, but or Office 365 tenant yet. But Microsoft Teams, I think, just turned on either AI noise cancellation or noise reduction system. So it's supposed to tune out a lot of that stuff. You know, laundry, you know, washers and dryers and dishwashers going on in the background. And I don't know about kids screaming, but kind of normal, you know, ambient sounds are supposed to all be tuned out. So, or they even have a demo of somebody opening a bag of potato chips. And, you know, you don't hear that crinkling, crackling sound of that, you know, the bag being opened.
Well, so I guess I'm going to Microsoft Teams full time then.
One of my group projects for the students is that they have to do a podcast.
Oh.
So those kids are very aware of how they sound, how they look.
Yeah.
Because they've had to practice that to create their podcast episodes.
Interesting. What kind of topics do your students are they given a topic, or do they just choose something they want to talk about? And
So I started out pretty free form, and then I moved to, it has to be something tourism related.
Uh-huh.
And they would, you know, I said, you know, you can be kind of broad in this, but it has to be around a theme and it has to be tourism related. And so this one group chose bars, and I said, you're all over 21. Yes, they're all over 21. But it turns out that one of the girls in the group didn't drink. And by the end of the semester, she was like going to bars every night.
Oh, no.
Like, oh, my God, what have I done?
Oh, no.
So I don't let them choose bars anymore. But, you know, they'll do tourism issues like beach erosion or over-tourism.
Yeah.
Or one group did it on hiking and one group did it on hotels and shopping and restaurants and desserts and coffee shops. And lately, I think last semester, I had four groups doing boba tea shops. That was like the big thing.
It's very big in Hawaii. I don't know about where you guys live, Don and John, but in Hawaii, it's huge.
New Hampshire, no, not so much.
And I should note that, you know, if you...
He doesn't even know what it is.
Yeah. It's tea with tapioca balls inside.
Oh, yeah, I've had it. I love it. But my wife is the only one who makes it within a 50-square-mile radius just because
sometimes
she had to import boba and cook it and everything.
Yeah, else. Sometimes it's called bubble tea, too.
Yeah.
And I should note that, you know, if you're wondering what Paul teaches, you pretty much know now. I mean, that's literally what his focus is.
Well, it brings an interesting thing to me, because the one class I am teaching next semester, because I have a number of course releases this year, is human factors engineering, which is always one of my favorite courses to teach. So I might co-opt that, create a podcast assignment, because that would be very interesting just for human factors and them learning about it firsthand by doing it.
Yeah.
I'll, my assignment.
I'm sorry, what was that, Paul?
I said, I'll send you my assignment, John. The,
what yeah.
Okay, and well, anyway, one of the things I wanted to mention is I went through, you know, speaking of Paul's assignment to his students to do a podcast. So even though I've been doing podcasting a long time and I've got a couple of mics I like, I really wanted something different. As I said, it's one thing to sit in front of, you know, my MacBook Pro for an hour talking to my friends with a fixed high-quality microphone. The Blue Yeti is a pretty high-quality USB microphone. And it's another to sit on a Windows machine, which is a, you know, torture in itself, but but sit in front of a Windows 10 machine for 10 hours, sometimes more, with headset on, with, you know, voices in your head, so to speak, which is a very uncomfortable feeling. And so I tried a bunch of headsets, I bought a bunch of microphones, and I ended up settling on something, a brand I've never heard of before or since, called Tunio, T-U-I-N-Y-O, which is a big, over, you know, big cans over the head headset. Pretty comfortable, it's Bluetooth. Terrible microphone was the problem. I tried it with John, and John says, well, I'm glad you can hear me, Todd, but I can't hear you, you know? And so I didn't want to give the headset because it was so comfortable and it worked. You know, I could stand up and walk away and fill up my cup and, you know, that kind of thing in a meeting. So what I ended up doing is I bought two lavs, lavalier microphones. One is a wired one with like a 12-foot cord, which is 12 inches too short to get to my sink in my home. So then I bought a Bluetooth lav, which works pretty well. And it's light and, you know, works just the way you think it would, except the battery dies. But, you know, not through, doesn't last a whole day. So I went back to the wired mic and just plan a little better. I can still get up and, you know, go pick something off the floor if I drop a pencil or something. Or, you know, walk over, you know, 10 feet and go get something I need with, you know. And I do mute myself so you can hear me shuffling around. But I can unmute myself pretty quickly.
I've found... My problem with Bluetooth for this type of thing, whether it be podcast or for work, there's always something that's sacrificed. I found the ones that are the most comfortable, like you said, over the year, long life.
Yeah,
the microphone tends to be lesser.
Yeah,
unless you pay a lot. I've had ones with great mics, but they're either short battery life or they're not the most comfortable.
Oh, they're expensive.
Yeah. It's always so hard to find. I've almost gotten to the point where it's like, okay, if I take slightly above average on across the board, okay, I win.
Yeah.
You know, because everything that has some great qualities always ends up having something that drives me crazy.
You know, one thing I've noticed, but I don't want to do, is, you know, when you watch, when you watch news these days, news interviews, and, you know, very few people are in studio anymore, so, you know, all the interviewees are remote. And almost to a person, they're wearing AirPods Pro in their ears, right? It's like a fashion accessory that everybody seems to wear.
Yeah. Sure,
you know, that's not why it's there. And I have AirPods Pro, but I don't want to use them today because I don't want to sully my Apple product by pairing it with a Windows product.
Are you sure that it wouldn't be rejected like a heart?
I mean, it could, right? It could.
Have you tried, Todd? They work really well with
Windows
products.
I have not. Does it mess up your pairing with your Apple products? That's the other thing. Like, does it infect your AirPods? So that it rejects on, you know, your Apple products. No, I just haven't tried them.
They work well, great with my Android phone. They work great with my Windows machine.
You know what I did buy that I kind of like, and it's really inexpensive. I think I paid $30. It's called a Jellycomb. Yeah, so it's a Jellycomb Bluetooth noise cancellation wireless earpiece. Notice singular. It's only in one ear, left or right. It's kind of... It doesn't care which side you use it on. It's over the ear. I'm not over. Let me rephrase that. Over the ear lobe, and it goes into the ear. So it's a, you know, earbud type setup. It's only one ear. It's got a nice microphone, and it kind of sticks out a few inches. And it's, like I said, it's $30. A charge lasts, I haven't used it all day, but I used it half a day with no problems. Because that's all I needed for. I use it in the office of all places, because I do go in my office once or twice a week. And I like to worm around.
You basically sound like you've described a Plantronics headset.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Which I remember those Except days it's $30. When you used to have them in the car.
Yeah.
That was before you had Bluetooth in the car. You right. always had that with a little boom.
Right.
And they were fantastic for noise cancellation, yep. and they worked great in the car for yep. hands-free driving, and you'd use them around the office.
Yep.
So, yeah.
So you know, those have worked. I think the mic might be a little soft. I need to go test the mic because, like everybody else, I don't test my own sound often enough. But people seem to be able to hear me. I can hear them just fine. And also, I usually wear it on my right ear because my right ear is facing my door. So if somebody comes to my door, they can see I'm, you know, I've got an earbud on and not just talking to myself, which I do anyway. But at least they know that pretty much I'm probably not talking to myself. And I can hear, you know, out of my left ear, so I can sort of hear people if they're calling me or something.
I seriously considered going and getting either a Jabra or a Plantronics,
yeah.
you know, which, you know, depending on the models, it's a blur now with Jabra and Plantronics. But I was thinking of getting one just dedicated for using with my computer for all the meetings same reason.
Yeah, actually at work, I've had a Jabra for years. It's kind of expensive. It's a couple hundred bucks, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah. it worked great, and I say worked because the headphone essentially eventually fell apart, literally. So I can't use it anymore, and, you know, just too expensive to go rebuy in these economic times. I don't want to be the guy that says, oh, yeah, I need a $300 headset, you know, versus the guy who says, I need a $550 AirPod Pro Max.
Need is such a subjective word, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's interesting what Paul said about the AirPods Pro working great. I know he said he's using, Bose, using a Bose noise cancellation headset. You sound great, by the way, Paul. So the microphone works fine, yeah. even though it's a non-boom mic. And also John's is that the Beats are have no boom mic on it. So it's kind of yeah. remarkable they work at all, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how the physics on that works.
You know, one of my biggest challenges has been with everybody going home, working from home, kind of what Don was saying earlier, where he used to go out and actually do things with clients. So my biggest client is the Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau, and I do all of their IT. And so I'm used to supporting one network and having one network up and running and protected and firewalled and all of that. Now all of a sudden in a week I have to do 60 networks.
Yep, it's absolutely, it's the same. I, as somebody who's been around mobility for years, when we went from issuing folks phones to everybody, the big thing, which for most businesses, let's be honest, the dirty little secret was because they thought it would cost less, BYOD, people started bringing their own devices, and nobody considered the support costs, especially with Android phones, of people showing up with every make, model, version of Android, and having to try to support those. But you're right, Paul, I can only imagine, yeah, like you said, everybody's on their own network, got their own setup, and you're trying to troubleshoot what should be a simple problem. And now it's so ridiculously complicated by comparison.
I mean, instead of having to know one router really well, I now have to know 20 different brands of routers,
yeah,
and different models, and they don't know their password, and they don't understand what ports are and how to make modifications to their routers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many. Yeah.
I was just saying, Paul can't just tell me, hey, just punch a hole in the router and port, you know, whatever, and you're done.
I can't tell you how many companies I know that open the floodgates with bring your own device, and they, as long as they, you know, they enroll them in device management.
Yeah.
And within 6 to 12 months on the Android side, we're saying, okay, I think the new philosophy is here is the subset of devices that are Android that will support Samsung, you know, and maybe one or two for that reason, because it just, nobody anticipated, despite being warned of what the ramifications of that would be.
Yeah, that's been interesting. I don't even want to get into networking. That's just a can of worms.
We were really fortunate that at the end of 2019, we started making a big push to get people to move stuff off of their network drive and onto OneDrive.
Because
we have Office 365, so they all have OneDrive. And if they put it in their personal OneDrive, it gets backed up automatically by Office 365. Right. So, you know, we said, okay, all the stuff you have on the G drive, on the server, we want you to move that off onto your OneDrive, and we're going to take your shared stuff and we're going to move it into SharePoint.
Yeah.
And so we were just doing that at the latter part of 2019, and now it's worked out wonderfully because they're all remote and everything's in SharePoint. They don't have to worry about how to VPN back into the office to connect to the server.
Yeah.
Right. And you've probably got multi-factor authentication and all of that, so they're all taken care of. Yeah, you know, the timing is everything, right? In fact, at the end of 2019, I was just starting to make the push to get everybody off Skype for Business, with sunsets July 2021, so we're like 6 months away from its sunsetting, and everybody onto Teams. And so when the pandemic hit, when it hit us in terms of everybody go home, it was like in March of this year. We had not quite finished the transition, but we had been well underway. You know, we had a couple months under our belt. And enough people were on that the transition was, I think, a lot less painful. Well, I shouldn't say transition. The work-at-home experience was a lot less painful than if we had had to move everybody to Teams as part of the telework experience, you know, versus having done it a few months ago. So, yeah, that was a big one. And I have to say, you know, I was not really happy with Teams when it first came out, but I kind of forced myself to start using it because I knew Skype for Business was going away and, you know, start to kind of accept it. I really like it now. When I retire, I'm going to kind of miss not having an enterprise level Teams platform to play with, because a consumer version of Teams is just sucky. But yeah, that's one of the things I probably will miss, is having a nice Teams, you know, platform to build stuff on. It's so easy. And I'm talking about no code build, you know, just Microsoft Lists, Planner, that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, and I think John's school is mostly on Google, if I recall correctly.
We're Office 365. We ditched Google about 3 years ago and moved everyone to 365.
Okay. The one other thing I wanted to mention was that, actually a couple of things, but we're running low on time. I bought like a half a dozen portable Bluetooth keyboards in the last year. They're all relatively low price, you know, nothing over $35, I think. So it didn't break the bank. Folding keyboards still don't work, in my opinion. It's one of those things, like, it's such a good idea, you want it to work, and I bought like two of them.
And how long have we been playing with that, Todd?
At least since the Pocket PC days, right?
Yep.
So at least 15 years, something like that, maybe more.
And it hasn't really evolved a whole heck of a lot.
It's one of those...
You remember what they told us 15 years ago, right? That there would just be this laser that projected the keyboard onto the surface in front of you.
Yeah, I remember that.
I had one of those. It didn't work.
Yeah. Well, not only did it work, but you hurt your fingers, right? Yeah. You know, there's a reason why you don't hit the table all day long with your fingers, you know, forcefully, because it hurts after a while. You know, so that you know, that 100-year-old joke, right? Doctor, it hurts when I do this. Stop doing that. Yeah, and then the other thing is, it's funny, so I bought three or four Anker keyboards, a little Bluetooth portable ones. They just kind of fit in my mini backpack with my iPad.
Yep.
I bought one for my wife. I think I bought one for my sister-in-law. Did I buy one for my daughter? And I think she said she didn't want one. And I bought two for me. No, I bought one for me. And then I wanted to buy another one to take to work when I switched out my Chromebook at work with an actual, you know, kind of like a mini PC, and I needed a keyboard I liked. And I couldn't find Anker keyboard on Amazon, at least. So I bought something called, I gotta read this because it's, the spelling never makes sense to me. Artek, A-R-T-E-C-K. It looks on the surface exactly like the Anker keyboard. I'm sure they're sourced from the same place. Mm-hmm. The keyboard layout is ever so slightly different, but not enough that my touch typing hands can tell. And it's like $30 or so. It's really reasonably priced. It's what I use at work now with my Windows PC. I have an Artek mini Bluetooth keyboard and mini, well, not regular size mouse, I guess, Bluetooth mouse. And the nice thing is they're both rechargeable, so I don't have to carry batteries for them around.
Yeah.
And John went the opposite way. So I tried all kinds of equipment, and John started like collapsing his equipment over the past year.
Yeah, I went from having old laptops in all of my offices so that I didn't have to carry a laptop around to just going to one device. I bought a 2020 MacBook Pro, the last Intel generation, and maxed out the specs and it just carried it around with me. And that, you know, I've done this a couple times in the last 10 years where I've gone one laptop and no, you know, nothing at my offices to then slowly the offices start getting computers again. And the pros, yeah, it's really great that it's set up once and done and the files are always in the same place and virtual machines are along with me and development tools and anything I could ever want. But the cons are just increase things to carry around. I was really liking that I just had a shoulder sleeve basically for my iPad Pro, and that was the only thing I was taking with me to work every day. So I'm very tempted to figure out how to do the majority of my workflow on a Raspberry Pi and have just two of those, one at each office, and be done with it.
Get a Raspberry Pi 400 when they come back in stock.
I've thought about it. But then, you know, in terms of my technology, my existing technology worked pretty well. Combination these Beats Solo 3s for when I'm at my desk, and my AirPods Pro for when I'm on the go has been pretty good. Built-in webcams. I did buy a lav mic for voiceovers, but the sound quality wasn't noticeably better in some cases than just using my laptop mic if I was sitting next to the laptop. So I haven't used it as much as I thought, but I went the opposite direction. I bought a bunch of stuff. I bought nothing really for mobility other than the laptop.
You do bring up something, though, John, when you mentioned virtualization. One thing that 2020 taught us is thanks to how far we've come with network performance and speed, virtual desktops aren't as crummy as they used to be. It's not, don't get me wrong. It's nice to have your OS right in hand, but the number of organizations that survived economically, businesses that survived because of remote desktop access and reasonable performance. I mean, it is a story, an IT story for 2020. I know I've worked with a number of organizations that probably wouldn't have made it this year if they weren't able to easily provide remote access that performed halfway decent. Yeah. And thankfully we've come far enough along to where, and for me, to a certain extent, there are times where just having a thin client type machine is enough to get by at points. But yeah, I looking back, if you had told me that we've come that far and that reasonable level of reliability. And like I said, there are organizations that I've worked with this year that were not small. We're talking thousands of users. And the fact that they were able to do that was the difference between them making it or not making it through the year. It'll be interesting to see how that changes over the next few years, our perception and how that gets used more in the business world.
Yeah, and I think it'll also be a matter of, go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I was going to say, it's interesting, Don, because we have tried over the years several different programs for doing remote access. We tried, there was, I don't know, PC remote, and there was this, and there was Log Me In, and what are we using now? Splashtop. Anyway, the one that has worked the best, to my surprise, was Microsoft's RDP.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're really good with VDI stuff, right, Don? More than
exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, and I was never the biggest fan of whether it be VMware's technology, Citrix technology, and the problem was partially the back end hardware needed to really improve, as well as networking needed to improve.
Yeah.
And now what you see, what Citrix has done, what VMware has done, I worked a lot with Horizon and enablement. And, you know, the days of I need a physical box for me one-to-one sitting someplace that I VPN into, that's what it used to be. To me, that was remote access because that was the only thing that was reasonably reliable. And now what I see, like I said, the organizations that I'm seeing are totally virtualized.
Yeah. Amazon Workspace.
And again, hundreds, if not thousands of users that if they did not do that, I can't imagine. Yeah. They were talking in some cases of weeks before they were in trouble with being able to survive as a business.
Yeah.
That's come a long way.
And I think it's going to be a matter of economics. You know, if we stay in telework mode going forward, as some companies are saying they're not going to do, where, you know, they're not going to call people back to the office. Remote support is tough. Ask Paul. And, you know, you can only have so many people doing the job because of economics. And you still have, you know, some number of people out there and you can't see them. You can't walk over to the desk and help them. And, you know, if they fry something, if it's a VDI environment, you just go, well, you know, we'll just spin up a new one for you. You know, we've got backup of your data. Here you go. You're attached. Okay, you're good to go.
Like I said, I am just floored by how far that technology has come over the last few years. I was always the one that having to work with it in the past.
Yeah.
You know, and having to work with it and not successfully. And now I've seen just the opposite. So I'll be curious to see how what's happened this year. 2, 3, 4 years down the road, how this will have impacted IT and how they look at deploying.
Yeah.
And I'm using air quotes here, desktops.
I keep saying yeah to you because I agree with what you're saying, but I actually don't care because I'm going to retire in 2 years. So I don't care what happens in 3 years from now.
730. Yeah.
You'll be curious as a hobbyist.
Will I? No. You know, as long as my broadband, you know, provider is up and running, and they've gone down 3 times this month for multiple hours at a time, by the way. As long as my broadband provider is working, Netflix is, you know, not exorbitantly priced, I'm good. I will have no curiosity at that point.
Don, after Todd retires, if it's not a streaming show about Bunny Rabbit
there you go.
Daily, Todd is not interested.
Not interested at all. And I watch K-dramas.
Down.
You know, so that's pretty much it. That will be my life.
I fully believe that I will have to do most of the show notes from that point on. Just, you know, Todd, you know, what did you do this week, Todd? Nothing. Okay, well, let me go find all the possible tech news that we could talk about.
Well, we do know that Todd will continue to show up because we know what happens when Todd doesn't show up.
Yeah, bad things are said about me, mostly by Don. but yeah, it's interesting, you know, what will happen. I just sent out some notes to folks I work with for, you know, planning for 2021. And that's just the known knowns, as a, you know, former Secretary of Defense once said. Just sort of the known knowns of we have to work on in the coming calendar year. And, you know, telework and continuing to enable it, making it better is, you know, amongst them, as well as bringing people back to work safely. And, you know, I assume that's going to happen at some point, but, you know, how we're going to do it is going to be another question. It's just, you know,
it's the unknown.
I just learned about portable micro sprayers the other week, and I did not really care to know about it, you know, how to disinfect a room and, you know, all those kind of things.
So as an interesting little aside about office space, when you mention it, I live in Salem, New Hampshire, about 30 miles north of Boston. And we have a huge development project. We're right on the border with Massachusetts, due north of Boston, and a huge development project that's going on that is a whole retail office mixed use that's being built. And in the last couple of months, the changes to their plans for office space to either switch to retail or residential.
Oh,
because of the space that has been had been previously figured would be leased office space. They said all their estimates are that they're not going to be able to lease it because we're seeing office space. What is existing will probably not be used in the same way as it was before, either in terms of density or how it's being used.
Yeah.
And so they've asked for zoning changes multiple times as a result of it. And I think it's a great little microcosm of what I think we'll see in metropolitan areas around the world, never mind around the country, is, you know, office spaces will still be used, but they will probably be used to hold far fewer people than they had been previously.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because Honolulu, which is not a large city, it's a city and it's considered a city, but it's not a large city like, say, New York or LA or anything like that, is one of the most densely populated areas in the U.S., I think, in terms of number of people per, you know, square mile. I'm not sure how they do the third dimension, because, you know, we have a lot of condos and stuff here in Hawaii, in Honolulu. And a lot of those are mixed office residential, and I assume they're going to remain that. But the buildings that are all office, you know, which even I think after everybody gets vaccinated, we may still have social distancing because of, you know, mutations of the virus and stuff. I don't know how we're going to do it. You know, office space is going to be a lot more expensive when you have to reduce the density by, you know, by 50% or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of, I know my company is looking at already, they were in the process of building new office space.
Yeah.
They're looking at taking that square footage and reorganizing the interior to be more socially distance friendly.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of, you're looking at a lot of office space, especially leased office space now, is already being looked at. How can we reorganize the interior to be less dense, to provide the value of the space in a post-COVID world?
You know, and I wonder, in the 1990s, I forget why people did this, mostly to be cheap probably, but there was a concept in offices called hoteling that you guys might recall. John might be too young to recall this, but the rest of us, Don, you might be too young too, but Paul and I probably remember it. And so the idea of hoteling, unlike the visitor stuff that Paul normally does, this is non-visitor stuff. The idea was to make office space more efficiently used by having people, mostly salespeople who aren't in the office very much, use shared or common spaces.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we're going to have hoteling for regular people, because, you know, non-salespeople. And because, you know, if you're only going to be in the office twice a month or four times a month, why do we need to dedicate, you know, the question might come up, why do we need to dedicate a space just for you?
Yeah. And that's, and interestingly enough, I had seen that start to take place in certain other areas, in consulting organizations. Mm. When you mentioned sales, consulting organizations were doing the same thing, where typically you would have open space and nobody owned a desk. There was a docking station and there were resources at each desk, and it was sort of first come, first served. You know, at if you needed to use the space.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to see that become far more prevalent as we've issued for so many workers. We've issued so many of these laptops, whether they be laptops, Chromebooks, mobile devices, to work remotely. Yeah, the need for a physical desk location for a lot of these people becomes less and less. It's more about access to peripherals and resources when they are in an office space that becomes
key. You know, and the other go ahead, Paul.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, we've gone to a situation where only the vice presidents have a private office and all the other private offices have been turned into like hotel spaces for other people to use. And the only change we made to that was one salesperson was so loud on the phone that they gave her her own office.
So there's a difference between hoteling and the open space, the open concepts. Blue that were open going spaces. On.
Yeah.
Okay. But which was all supposedly all about collaboration, but at least in several instances that I saw were about not wanting, wanting to be able to keep an eye on people a little bit more and not use up as much space, square footage for office. And I can tell you, the ones that didn't do it for the right reasons suffer typically. You just hit, Paul, the worst case scenario. I worked in organizations where they went that route, but everybody in the same area was on a telephone.
Yep.
And fortunately, we had noise-canceling headphones, so our customers would not hear.
Right.
But we could hear each other, and it was the most distracting and disturbing way to try to perform business.
Yep.
And so, and now they're finding that most, that I just saw another study that had been done the last 10, 15 years, most people that did open concept did it for the wrong reasons and found their workers to be less productive as a result of it.
And now sicker. So,
yeah. And, but now, like I said, I can see that that space, if you're doing it not for permanent desk space, but you're doing it for hoteling or, you know, that could possibly work.
Yeah.
Because you're not expecting full capacity in that large open space.
Yeah. A couple of things about, I think the guy who invented the open space, open office concept apologized a year or so ago. I mean, seriously, it was in the New Yorker magazine or Atlantic, you know, pretty respectable publication, and just said, well, you know, people just did it the wrong way. That's not what I intended.
It was supposed to encourage collaboration, but I saw it time and time again, just putting more people into less space.
Yeah. And, you know, where I work, a bunch of folks moved into a large area that used to have 27 people and now has 80 seats. And the first full year we were there, I think we had at one point, this is pre-COVID-19, right? This is like 2018. I think we had 20-25% of people out sick. Soon after we moved in, and we moved in November, so you know, Hawaii doesn't get cold, so you know, we can't blame being indoors more, but just being in there with 80 people instead of 27, we had 20-25% people out sick at any one time for weeks on end, and then COVID hit.
it's interesting. I will be curious. That's another one when Todd's off, you know, tending to the. To the buns, as a rabbit farmer, and we're all still trudging away. I will be interested to see how office space is used in 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah, I would be interested, but I'll ask you guys what you think.
In passing.
Yeah. We probably won't ask you about rabbit husbandry.
Well, you know, I don't breed rabbits, right? We just have them as pets. So,
Although you never know what the future holds.
No, I'm going to be too old to chase pets around. They do need a lot of attention, and I'll be just.
You're going to train the older ones to manage the younger ones. You're going to use your psychology that you haven't used in years, and you're.
One more thing I want to mention about offices and, you know, returning or not, conference rooms, which used to be, I don't know about where you guys work or worked in the past, but for me, having a conference room available was like one of the biggest problems, you know, that everybody has. Like, I need to go meet with, you know, 4 people or 5 people. Where do I go? My office isn't big enough, or I don't have an office. I have an open space cubicle, which is, you know, we could put 4 people in there, but then, you know, it bothered the 4 or 5 people around us. We could never find conference rooms, right? And now, you know, we kind of don't need them anymore. Everybody's trained to go on vid and say, just pop your mic on, we'll talk, you know, 4 or 5 of us like we are now. And it's funny because just a few months ago, I had a vendor come to me and say, hey, you know, we're pushing these Microsoft Teams compatible hardware, and it's for small groups and, you know, for your conference room. And I said, we don't use our conference room anymore. You know, I think we use it to stand up equipment, you know, to do testing. That's about it. People don't go in there anymore. And they go, oh, yeah. And I said, plus what you're trying to sell is just way too big.
Yeah.
Yeah. All righty, gang. Well, we did it. The last podcast of 2020 is in the can. I want to thank John for hanging in there with me for all these years on these podcasts. Don and Paul for being able to come on short notice. All the other guests we've had over the years, and especially this year, where it's been especially... Well, people are mostly home, so it wasn't that challenging. Because most people weren't challenging. But to Swin and Jack Cook and, you know, all the other folks that dropped by to talk with us, thank you. It's always a privilege and a pleasure to talk with folks. Anyway, last podcast, 345. It's like a perfect right triangle, right? 345. is in the can, and we will talk to you next time.